Hello, I'm Michaela Maguire, Artistic Director of Melbourne Writers Festival. You're listening to a conversation from our 2022 podcast series.
Here we go. Good evening. Hi, good evening and welcome to Melbourne Writers Festival and Queer Stories. We respectfully acknowledge that today we are meeting on the lands of the Kulin Nations, in particular the Wurundjeri Woiwurrung people. We pay respects to elders past and present. Sovereignty was never ceded, always was, always will be Aboriginal land. So good evening and welcome to Queer Stories. I am your host, Maeve Marsden, and I'm thrilled to be here for the first live Queer Stories event in Melbourne since February 2020. Yes, it's really nice. It's really nice to be back with you all. It's been a very long 30 months, and a lot has happened, most noticeably in that time I had a baby and everyone else had COVID. It's good times for all. Welcome to those who used to come to the shows at the Melbourne Spiegel Tent or Howler. I'm less likely tonight to drunkenly flirt with you than I used to be because the aforementioned baby woke me up at 5 a.m. But I'm tired, so who knows? Anything could happen. Anything could happen. And I'm so excited to be here. Welcome to those unfamiliar with Queer Stories. Have some of you never been to a Queer Stories event before? Can I get like a gentle woo? Oh, you put hands up. It is quite a, like, academic feeling space, isn't it? Everyone, give me a woo if you haven't been to one before. And give me a guttural grunt if you have. I'm going to flirt with you guys. That was good. I liked it. That's about half and half. So look, for the uninitiated, I've been producing these live storytelling events around the country for about 7 years. So more than 300 wonderful LGBTQI plus people have now shared a tale. My brief for the writers, and we've got fantastic writers with us tonight, is broad. I say, tell the story you want to tell but are never asked to. This prompt for me is about saying we're so often asked to tell our stories as queer people through the gaze of a cisgender or a heterosexual world. We're asked to come out over and over and over again, and I am quite sick of coming out stories. I don't know about you. And of course we all have one, but I wanted to know, what are these stories that you wish people asked about? These things about yourself that might be queer or might be completely unrelated to your gender or sexuality identity. And that brief has worked. For 7 years, we've had such diverse and fantastic stories, often funny, often heartbreaking, sometimes raunchy, and we've got a mix of all of that for you tonight. That prompt was perhaps difficult for writers because it's literally their job to tell you the stories you didn't ask for and then convince you to buy books about them. But still, they managed to deliver such beautiful work tonight, and we've got some wonderful surprises for you. So without further ado and without too much more of me, I'll introduce our first storyteller. C.S. Packett is the author of the New York Times and USA Today bestseller Dark Rise, the Captive Prince trilogy, and the GLAAD-nominated graphic novel series Fence. Born in Australia, C.S. has since lived in a number of cities and currently resides and writes in Melbourne. Please make them very, very welcome. C.S.
Hello. I was talking to someone in my family about this event, and they said, you should tell the story about the tram conductor. While I was thinking this over, they said, you know, you get your storytelling from the family, you should tell them that. And I said, yeah, okay, I'll tell them that. My family tells stories. They don't write things down. It's an oral tradition with them. The best storyteller in my family was my grandfather. He comes from that lost world of the old Italian village. No television, no internet, barely a radio. You can't read or write, but you do sit around at night telling stories. And I think I subliminally learned from him that the person who is the best storyteller in any room is the one with the most power. We'd sit around and put in requests to him, like, nonno, that's the word for grandfather in Italian, racconta la storia della crocchette, like, tell the story of the croquettes, tell the one about climbing the fig tree. And we wanted to hear the same stories over and over again. And sometimes my mother would even say, oh, we should tape your grandfather's stories. It would be such a shame to have these stories disappear. But the stories did disappear. He died about 10 years ago. So here's the fragments that I remember. This is all that's really left. of my grandfather. The one about the croquettes was something about how my grandmother and grandfather were having a fight while my mother was making the potato croquettes. So that's mashed potato that's carved into a ring, shaped into a ring, and then fried in hot oil. And as they were fighting, she threw the pan at him. And the potatoes arced up into the air and they hit the ceilings where they were suspended, sort of stuck like the Olympic rings. And the ceiling was too high to get them down easily. And so then when the fight entered its Cold War phase where they weren't talking to each other and they just sat silently at the dinner table, but every now and again one of the croquettes would fall down from the ceiling onto the table. And the one about the fig tree I remember less well, but it was something about how while my grandmother and grandfather were having a fight, my grandfather climbed the fig tree in the front garden, then somehow lost both the ladder and the rope that he used once he broke his belt to hold up his pants. So his pants fell down and he was screaming for my grandmother, Eva, that was her name, Eva, Eva. But she didn't answer because they were having a fight. And so he went off on a tirade like, Vaffanculo, via diavolo. And then when she finally emerged, it was only to see the nuns from St. Bridget's averting their eyes and making the sign of the cross in front of the pantsless man in the tree in his underwear swearing. So the story that my family used to tell about me was the story about the tram conductor. I was in year seven, so what's that, like 11 or 12 years old? And I needed an alarm clock for a school project. And actually, that part of the story is a lie. I told everyone I needed the alarm clock for a school project, but I actually needed it for a prank. I'd convinced a group of friends that we should all bring alarm clocks to school and hide them around the school hall, then set them to go off during school assembly. But at 5-minute intervals, so that the idea was as soon as one alarm clock would be found and shut off, another one would start ringing. I was an only child. My father, he died when I was about 5, and my mother raised me as a single parent. My school was about an hour and a half tram ride from my house, so I used to get up before my mother in the mornings. And the morning of the prank, I snuck into her bedroom, took her alarm clock while she was still asleep, slipped it into my school backpack and headed off for the prank. I was about halfway down the hallway when I heard her say, "You give that back, you little redacted." And I said, "I need it for a school project." And we wrestled for control of the backpack. I managed to grab it and run out of the house. And she followed me out, still in her nightdress. In my 12-year-old mind, I was thinking like two moves ahead, like in chess. I've got a head start. She's in her nightdress. If I can just get to the tram and get on the tram, she's not going to follow me. I'm home free. So she wore like one of those long white nightdresses with small pastel flowers on it, made out of some kind of nightdressy fabric like flannel. Unmistakably a nightdress. And this was like 1989, so not like today where everyone works from home and we're all basically wearing our pajamas all day anyway. Like women didn't really go outside in their nightdress in 1989. I saw the tram coming, I ran as fast as I could and I made it on there just as the doors closed, sat down in the nearest seat, feeling pretty proud of myself, I'm clear. Then the light turned red, the tram did not pull away from the stop. It just sat there as the seconds ticked by, 20 seconds, 30 seconds, and then, in her nightdress, my mother got onto the tram after me. So I remember she grabbed me by the hair and dragged me down the centre aisle of the tram. "You redacted, you give me back that alarm clock." And I was telling stories. "I need it for a school project." Actually, I think I probably started with, "I don't have the alarm clock," and then moved on to, "but I need it for a school project." She hit my head against one of the seats. I was clinging to the backpack. I didn't have really a plan. There's not really an obvious way out of the situation. And that was when the tram conductor stepped forward. You remember tram conductors, or some of you might not, but They used to wear a uniform with a cap, and they had those leather satchels that they slung over their over one arm. And inside the leather satchel, they'd have money, and they'd have change and paper tickets that they'd click with a clicker to denote that they'd taken your fare. And in a very dignified voice, the conductor said, "Ma'am, no violence on the trams, please." As if he was indicating to a sign, as if they had somewhere on the tram a little picture of a woman in a nightdress going with a cross through it. And my mother answered, "This is my daughter. I can do whatever I like." You know that sort of comment, like, don't tell me what I can do with my daughter. The conductor, perhaps realising that he too had a fiefdom, he said to her, "Well, do you have a ticket?" Silence. Then she turned her head to me and she said, "You redacted, you give me money for a ticket." In an act that probably epitomises my personality in that era, I just shook my head. "No way. Ma'am, I'm afraid if you do not have a ticket, you cannot ride my tram." Now, the tram had been moving the whole time. At this point, we were probably more than 20 or 30 blocks away from my house. My mother was barefoot and in her nightdress, and she didn't have her purse, which meant she probably did not have her house key either. And she was put off the tram. That's where my family ends the story. And that's where I usually end the story as well. I don't talk about what it felt like to sit down, do my hair, and sit in front of the other passengers on the tram the rest of the way to school. And I don't talk about what happened to me that night when I got home. People loved my grandfather, and they used to say things like, "Your grandfather, he was a real character," as if he'd stepped out of one of his own stories. And as I got older, I came to see the way that his stories completely obscured, even to his own family, the violence of the man. You could tell those stories a different way. You know, the story about the fig tree could just be a story about a man screaming obscenities at his wife. And the story about the croquette could be a story about a family where it was pretty normal to throw a pan of boiling hot oil at another person. And I think the story about the conductor, if I really think about what it's about how by the time I was 11, I was already too scared to ask my mother if I could borrow the alarm clock. But my grandfather had this facility to kind of rewrite reality by storifying it. And the story became more real than the event. When he died, it was like a spell was broken in my family, and I was really, really happy to let those stories fade. But I can see why, for example, my mother really needed them. Because when something's happening inside the house, you often end up performing kind of a production of reality when you're on the outside. Bad things are minimized or hidden or made to seem engaging or funny. It's a way to cope. And I grew up to be a fantasy novelist. And so that's why when I got told, I think your ability to tell stories comes from your family. You should tell them that at the event. I thought, yeah, all right, I will.
Thank you so much. It was an incredible piece of writing, and I think stories about storytelling and about family are some of my favourites, and it was incredibly affecting. I also think that the path from teenager who comes up with really creative pranks to queer adult is a straight line. So thank you so much, CS, for that piece. Next up, Crystal DiNapoli is a Camilla Rowe author and astrophysicist devoted to the advocacy of Indigenous knowledges and equity in STEM. She is the co-author of Astronomy, Sky Country, published this year, which explores the wondrous interconnected world of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander astronomy. Please welcome Crystal to the stage.
Ooh. All right, I hope you can all hear me fine. I know I'm shorter than most, so I don't know with the microphone, but seems good so far. So I know with quiz stories, one of the briefs that we get is tell the story that you always want to tell, but you've never been asked to tell. And for anyone who has actually read my book that I co-authored with Carly Noon, some parts of this story might seem familiar to you, but in essence, I've never told this story. Not in this way, not with the way that it links into key moments in my life. And so I'll be doing that tonight. And yeah, we'll see how it goes. Hopefully you can take something from it. I feel like I'm floating in space. My back pressed atop of a secondhand trampoline to which loose springs desperately cling. They are struggling under the weight of three observers, two children and their mother. I hear the rustle of leaves caught in the fervour of a light summer wind. The air is warm and inviting, like a welcoming embrace from country, wrapping me in the comfort of home. Beside me, I hear the murmurs of my companions, the excited whispers of my older sister, Caitlin, as she too finds herself drawn to the spectacle above us, the soothing tones of my mother's voice as she responds to Caitlin's candid curiosity in kind. Above, unimpeded dark skies showcase an uncountable collection of stars, shimmering as though they're performing just for us. They are surrounded by the kind of darkness that one can only find in these rural places. My eyes flick around as I try to absorb what I'm seeing. This is the first time in my short life that I'd really looked at the night sky. The stars are seemingly endless. At first, my eyes are drawn to the brightest of them. So many luminous spots demanding to be seen, twinkling gently to their own rhythm. Blues, reds, oranges, colours beyond the bright white that they initially present. I feel weightless. I feel like I'm falling upward into the ocean of bright lights above me, floating amongst their brilliance. My sister's voice grows louder. It pulls me out of my awe-induced trance. She's thrilled about something. She's found something more within these stars that I have not. Ah, the short-lived visit of a shooting star, she claims. And another shooting star. And another. And another. I feel a frustration brewing within me. The heat rises to my face. Why do these special stars continuously elude me? Are we not looking at the exact same skies? Are we not looking at the same darkness and the same vivid colours beyond the light? No, apparently not. I can't see what she's seeing. I voice this frustration. My sister is amused at my envy, or at least it feels like she is, but the comforting, melodic tones of my mother's voice interrupt. She reassures me. How about we start simply? She begins to describe an array of constellations apparently known by many. In the low light, I see her hand guide my gaze upwards. The Southern Cross, the Hunter Orion. My sister exclaims as she spots them too. My frustration grows as my eyes continue to betray me. Perhaps I'm not worthy of their performance. My mum speaks again. Can you see the seven sisters? They are faint, but they are my favourite. They are a group of girls huddled together in strength and safety. There's something that draws me to them. The power of feminine love and protection. They're always pursued by Orion as he chases them across the skies. But they always have each other. My mother is the youngest of her sisters. I'm the second oldest of mine. I can't spot any of the features she tries to show me, but I try not to wallow in the failure. Instead, I cling to this gift she has given me. I don't yet know what it is, but I feel the spark of it being ignited within my heart. My mum's words had inspired me. I spent many nights since then gazing upwards and finding myself lost within the skies. In the next decade, I overcame many hardships to become one of the first people in my family to finish high school, and then the very first to go to university. I was offered the chance to prove myself in a semester-long entry course to get into my dream science degree. All that stood between me and this goal was a semester of hard work and three final exams. I sat two of my exams without incident, but it was in the day prior to my third and final exam, the one that would secure my place as a student of science, where I was awoken by a flurry of calls. The voice on the other end of the phone spoke the five words that would change me forevermore. "Crystal, your mum is dead." My mum had passed away very suddenly at the young age of 37, leaving me and my six siblings behind. I had to break the news to some of my siblings, the youngest of which was only 6 years old. I didn't know what words could comfort someone so young in the throes of grief, so I explained it the only way I knew how. I told them Mum is gone now, and that it might not make a lot of sense, and it might not seem very fair, but she has work to do. She's found her place in the skies. She's become the star that will guide us in our lives. You will see her. She's the very first star to appear to you at night. When I return on my path, Mum's words echo in my head and my soul. I return to science and I pursue the skies as an astrophysicist, grounded in the cultural lens of our Gomeroi culture. I learn, I teach, I create. I travel around the country sharing what I know. I write, I speak, I share. I become a storyteller much in the way that she once was. Once again, I find myself lying beneath pristine dark skies, losing myself within them. Many years have passed since I first gazed at these stars with my mother. The stars look the same, but we have all changed greatly. Caitlin is no longer a child, but has since become the mother of two girls of her own, my beautiful nieces. I have changed in many ways myself. My life has since been enriched with a deep knowledge of the skies, but has suffered many great losses as well. I feel the harsh crunch of sand under my back, a clear contrast to the supportive weightlessness of the trampoline at home. My work takes me places that I never dreamed I would one day experience. The night is again warm, as it once was, but the air's embrace carries the unusual scent of salt. Unfamiliar sounds encompass me. The crashing waves of the beach are just beyond the tips of my feet. I feel overwhelmed by their calls. So far, I'd spent most of my life in the bounds of a landlocked rural town, always dreaming of a closeness to the water-hugged edges of this country. I inherited this longing from my mother, who had always dreamed to one day see a beach for herself. This thought cuts me as I feel myself pulled back into the memories of that night with her. My body lies here on the beach, but my mind drifts into our past. The curiosity she gifted me began as a mere spark, but has since evolved into a roaring fire that courses through my bones. I feel a bitterness, sadness, for now I can see everything she wanted me to see. The Southern Cross as it sits atop of the head of the dark emu in the sky. Orion the Hunter, now a familiar friend I wait to visit in the warmer months. Still, a bitterness, a sadness persists. Casting my eyes deep into the ocean of stars above me, I challenge myself. I follow the gaze of Orion in his eternal pursuit. I look for the sisters. I look for the sisters that my mother had shown us, the faint cluster of stars that have guided our ancestors for millennia before us. I look for the sisters whose resilience and camaraderie remind me to fiercely protect and love my darling sisters that my mother gave me. I look for the sisters who I now cling to as I desperately dig into the depths of my memories, hoping to maybe catch the sound of her voice one last time. I still feel her company in these moments. She sits with me as I look to the sisters. She walks alongside me as I pursue a life dedicated to the skies. Her spirit emanates within the curiosity of my darling little nieces, who sit and listen as I tell them of the sisters in the words that she had once bestowed upon me and their mother. Suddenly, I see a flash of light. The once elusive shooting star finally crosses the skies in front of me. Although my mother is no longer of this earth, she endures within the stars. Although the waves of the beach eluded her, she is at home in the ocean above. Thank you.
That was incredibly moving and beautiful. Thank you, Crystal. Next up, Eve Rees is a historian at La Trobe University, co-host of the Archive Fever podcast, and author of All About Eve, Notes from a Transition. They are also co-editor of Nothing to Hide, Voices of Trans and Gender Diverse Australia. Eve was awarded the 2020 Calibre Essay Prize and has a beautiful story for us tonight. Welcome.
Most of the time, I do a decent impression of an inner city queer. I have the tattoos, the undercut, the body hair. I walk around in colourful, ironic boiler suits, carrying a pretentious tote bag and a soy flat white. My Northcote apartment is filled with houseplants, moleskin notebooks, and the collected works of Maggie Nelson. I own a bike instead of a car, and though I technically have a license, I'd rather pash Barnaby Joyce than actually drive anywhere. But I'm here to make a confession. I'm here to tell you that all that good performative queerness hides a deeper, shameful truth. At heart, I'm a hiking nerd. That's right, I'm a devotee of the very wholesome, very non-urban, very unhip and very straight world of multi-day bushwalking. 5 days of blisters and no showers, eating trail mix and sleeping on the damp ground. Now that's my idea of heaven. Later this year, I'm even dedicating 2 weeks of annual leave to a 16-day hike on Victoria's western coast. That's right, I could go to New York or Berlin for my holidays, but instead I'm walking to Nelson. I love the walking itself, but I especially love the apparatus of hiking, the stuff. I'm what they call a gearhead, the kind of tedious bore who fixates on gadgets and gets a real kick off shaving 10 or 20 grams off overall pack weight. My idea of heaven is to browse Bogon camping supplies on Little Bourke Street, comparing the relative size and weight of different camping mugs. In my free time, I daydream about hiking socks. And I'm on a lifelong quest to produce the optimal menu of dehydrated foods. Maximum taste for minimal weight. After every walk, I'd write up notes about what worked and what didn't, always in pursuit of the ultimate kit. Next time, or the time after that, I will have perfected my packing list. Now, in many ways, I'm an unlikely devotee of Gore-Tex. Not only am I a bookish queer allergic to sports, but there was no camping in my childhood. My parents didn't own a tent, and their idea of a good time was more Sydney hotel than sleeping bag. My entry into the hiking cult happened by accident when I joined Duke of Ed in year 10. There's a few knowing groans in the audience. Now, for anyone who doesn't know, The Duke of Edinburgh Award Scheme was a youth development program that, amongst other things, taught the basics of hiking, like how to read a map and use a compass. It involved hordes of rowdy teens heading off into the bush with our, in retrospect, very noble high school math teacher and her husband. Our first training walk in March 2003 did not get off to a good start. It was designed to be a simple day walk in some local bushland, a low-stakes opportunity to test out our newfound compass skills. We divided into small groups, each with a Year 11 trainer and a supervising parent, and set off into the scrub. The first sign that something was wrong was the helicopter. It buzzed overhead around lunchtime as we stopped to eat our sandwiches. A rescue helicopter, how dramatic, how exciting. We knew, of course, that it must be for someone else. We were on a perfectly safe training session. Nothing bad would happen to us. Rescue helicopters were the kind of thing that happened to other people. Several hours later, my group stomped into the car park, sweaty but triumphant. Mission accomplished. We had successfully deciphered the swirl of lines on the topographic map. Time for a shower and a hot meal. Then we saw the faces. Grim, stunned faces, cheeks streaked with tears. There'd been an accident, we were told. An older boy, one of the Year 11 trainers, had fallen off a cliff. He'd walked ahead of the group, and suddenly the ground had disappeared. He'd fallen 20 metres. He died. He was dead. My mother, my hiking novice mother, who was just there to make up the numbers. She was a parent in that group. She'd walked with him that morning, had watched him run ahead of the others, had been one of the last people to see him alive. David, that was his name. I'll never forget the aching silence that filled the car as we walked home, as we drove home. After David died, things fell apart fast. He was an older kid that I'd never really known, but his death shook my whole community. It was an age before grief counsellors and trauma literacy, and we kids stumbled around, shook and numb, lacking the skills or language to process the experience. My beloved maths teacher, the Duke of Ed coordinator, went on stress leave and returned a shadow of her former self. David's parents, who owned the local health food store, were reduced to walking ghosts. And my mum, who'd been in David's group, she was hollowed out by shock and sadness. For months afterwards, she felt haunted and her health crumbled. For her, David's death was the final devastating blow after a run of bad luck. In the previous 4 years, she'd dealt with a humiliating redundancy, a marriage breakdown, a parent's terminal illness, and my own anorexia. Now this accident. She retreated to bed, sick and sad, her body ravaged by painful inflammation. That year, Mum was diagnosed with a chronic illness that still shapes her life today, almost 20 years on. These days, she's better than she was, but she can't bushwalk anymore. David's death meant a lot of things to different people, but in the story of my life, it was a moment when things fell apart. When the adults in the room went to pieces and I realised grown-ups were not gods. When my mother, my best friend, my main carer, my whole universe disappeared into a black hole of sickness and I had to grow up fast. It was a loss of innocence, a fall, both literal and figurative, from the blind trust of childhood into the painful realities of adult life. You see, as you might have figured out by now, I'm not just here to confess my hiking proclivities. I'm here to talk about death and what it does to those left behind. You might not have expected this dark turn, but neither did we. David's death came out of nowhere on a sunny Sunday morning full of good cheer. There was no warning, no ominous signs, and that made it all the more shocking to live through. None of us returned from that hike the same person. But in the aftermath, we did return to the trail. David's death didn't turn us off hiking. In fact, the opposite happened. My Duke of Ed cohort was bound together by this tragedy, and we spent the next 3 years trudging through the bush on weekends and school holidays. In my 20s, I dragged my partner on hiking vacations in New Zealand and Tasmania. And these days, I hike solo or with friends. I've spent thousands upon thousands on hiking gear, and I've always got my eye on the next purchase. In psychology, there's a concept called repetition compulsion. Originally coined by Freud, repetition compulsion is used to describe how we humans continually repeat the past, especially painful or destructive events. There are lots of theories about why this happens, but one school of thought suggests that we relive our traumas in order to fix them. We cycle back to that painful moment again and again and again in hopes that this time we'll rewrite the story and put everything right. Recently, I've been wondering if repetition compulsion can explain my compulsive passion for hiking, and especially hiking gear. Maybe I keep returning to the trail each time with better and better equipment in an effort to revisit my original hike and change the outcome. This time, or the next, or the one after that, I'll have perfected my planning. I'll have absolutely foolproof gear, and nothing will go wrong. David won't die, Mum won't get sick, and I will get to keep believing the world is safe. I just need to try a little bit harder. I just need to buy a new raincoat, or find better snacks, or take a different hat. If I can just make the walk perfect, everything will be okay after all. It hasn't happened yet, but I'll probably keep trying. And in the meantime, you can catch me on the trail. I'll be the one dressed in head-to-toe Gore-Tex, eating dehydrated hummus, and trying to get my portable solar panel to work. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Another excellent piece of writing. I do love doing the Writers Festival Queer Stories events. They're always a treat. Next up, Omar Saker is the author of two acclaimed poetry collections, These Wild Houses and The Lost Arabs, which won the 2020 Prime Minister's Literary Award for Poetry. His debut novel, Son of Sin, is out now, and you should definitely buy it. Please welcome Omar.
Assalamu alaikum. So, every time Maeve asks me to do one of these tell a story. I always say no. It's true. I always say no. I never have time to write a story, and instead I say, but I can read some poems. To which she usually says, yeah, all right. Like, if you must. If you must. But at least tell a story beforehand. So, it was 2017. Was what I had called at the time the year of dick. And I'd sworn off women. Tired of it. Over it. And I was only going to date and hook up with men, which I did for several months. And things were looking up for me at the time. I had several events at the Emerging Writers Festival. Coming up, I was very excited. I had a festival in Mexico the month after. And then a dear friend of mine passed away the week of the Emerging Writers Festival. And 2 days after that, my father passed away. And then 3 days after that, my uncle, his brother, also passed away. It is a kind of absurdity, the amount of grief that fell upon me that week. And it's, you know, something I'll never actually be able to articulate properly, I feel. So I didn't do the Emerging Writers Festival events, naturally, but I did go to Mexico. And that is the backstory for this poem. So, this is what happened afterward when I got back. And this poem is called When the Veil Parts. We hooked up 6 weeks after the funeral. That must be how long it took my departed father to beg God for his son to fall in love with a woman. I never imagined a life like this, one in which I am happy, and knowing it has ruined the future. We can only dwindle now. I try not to bother you with this foreshadowing. I watch movies. I earn small dollars, count down the hours, lap the block of decaying animals, avoid the bees beginning their dizzy deliverance around helpless flowers. I do not call my mother. I laugh eerily at whatever my brother sends me. In fact, as soon as I see his name, humor wedges my spine. I fuck you on good days and bad. We argue about the dishes. I use dildos to teach myself new raptures when I am alone. This has nothing to do with your womanhood. It is mine. A long hand-held heaven because I haven't met a man I trust enough to deliver me there. And this is one way we are both women. You ask me what this is about as I write it. Mandarins, I lie and taste citrus. I don't know how to be anything other than queer and sad. I need to map a way out of this unexpected complication, and all I can think to say is ta bene. We part sometimes, and you work and sleep as I do, but these are false previews of absence predicated on return. I no longer look at mandarins except as an omen for loss. It's not all bad news. My father, God bless him, already proved that when life ends, love enters. So, basically, a couple of months afterward, I met my current wife. And a couple of months after that, I was at a residency in America, which, for a couple of months, and their internet blocked you from accessing porn. And so that's what this poem is about. It's called I Felt Like a Saint. The residency accommodated artists for months at a time. A bedroom, a shower, a kitchen, a studio, a haunting snow. Their internet smothered smut tried to keep me from being a slut. My love, a world away, went hunting through archives for the sex I described. I felt like a saint, she told me. Three or more steps removed from desire, crowned by a light that can only come from sinning in another's place to know their ache. For you, I will mouth a fantasy halo, dribble, devour, suck. The law of balance demands I devil your holy. Instead, I do nothing. Watch magpies mating outside my window. Well, the birds stood close, perhaps talking. Unexpectedly, even magpies need love. Never have I felt more perverse. The space between us is full of bodies paused. I jerk off just to feel normal again and to honor her labor, the diligent record of other people mourning nude for the camera, all the little deaths. Our screens stay dark. Ecstatic portals. You can be the patron of tribbing, I say. I will be the song of absence. Now press play on those men, please. Yeah. She found me porn and recorded it. And sent it to me and I wrote a fucking poem about it, because that's what I do. Anyway. This poem is about watching TV, sort of, but not really. It's called Runtime. One episode in, I declare I would die for them. Any character from my life is worth dying for when they're on a screen. It's so easy to love them there. I want tea or coffee to ripstart a chain store in my heart. I swear this sandwich is so good, kill me. We're dancing in a flood of light, and my body won't stop trying to find another way to close. Like any failed alchemist, all I know is how to take a good thing and make of it a menace. This is what the world did with God, and yes, I am the world, and no, I won't learn my lessons. I'm in the metaphor factory again, fighting for my beard to be a beard, and on the way out, this jalabiya becomes my eternal shroud. No. Song. Today, I'm going to run at the police barricades in a lip sync for my life. I'm tired of mouthing what I must in order to survive. I'm going to run at the gun after I kiss a faggot on the lips. I am the faggot on my lips, and I am running toward a choice that is not inevitable. Doom feels so delicious on my skin. Don't you love to shiver in the ending? Isn't it in the ending that we get to triumph? Or is that only after tragedy? In the after or before, tell me what's waiting. Is it a gun or parade? I'm trying to cook up a revolution here. Of course the kitchen's on fire. I can put it out or read the secret songs of smoke, but not both. I'm reading the earth with a sore melodious throat, watching the house sashay away to great acclaim in a little black dress. It was never my house. Never my mind, never mine, but I own this dress, believe me. I want to tear out the good pages of every book and eat the cheap paper. The good pages will be those I land on, or the ones without people. Fuck. I think I finally understand the romantics, and this is why I laugh, stumbling, hysterical, free as I run and run toward the only certainty I know.
You can see why, even though Omar refuses my format every time, I always say yes. Fantastic. There's a funny thing that happens at Queer Stories events. I've done so many of them now, and sometimes I end up with five or six incredibly different, disparate stories in both topic and tone. And we were talking upstairs, and tonight I said, well, we've got grief and sex.
and in Omar's story, both. And I think there's nothing queerer than that, to smush the raunch and the sorrow up against each other, as we so often do. So with Omar, the path through grief and sex will end on our raunchiest, though for the full adults-only version, you will have to buy the book. We had to cut it back to word count. Finally tonight, boy, girl, artist, advocate, Shane Jenick, aka Courtney Act, is more than the sum of their parts. Shane shares the story of their rise to national and global fame as beloved drag and entertainment icon, Courtney Act, in Caught in the Act, I love a pun, which is about their journey towards understanding gender, sexuality, and identity. Please welcome Shane.
Hello. I sent Maeve a few stories. All of them were sex-related for some reason. Well, because she said, what kind of story would you like to tell? It doesn't have to be a story for a straight audience. And so I thought, well, I'll talk about sex then. But we did... Is anybody wearing pearls this evening, by any chance? Because on your head... Okay, well, if at some point you need to clutch them... Oh, I just thought there's young people in the audience. Well, there is some adult content coming, so... You've read the book. Okay, you've read the book. Okay, good, cool. This is actually the first story. When I sat down to write my book, I was like, oh, I don't want to write about childhood. That's boring. And I thought, who do I want to write about? And I was like, ah. And so this was the first story that I wrote. I knew he would be cute, but I didn't expect there to be an instant connection the moment our eyes locked. We'd both stopped to look at each other against the backdrop of a bustling dressing room, and we were abruptly snapped back to reality by the promoter making an announcement to the room, "All right, everybody, let's clear out, give these two some privacy." As he walked past, he leaned in and whispered, "See, I told you Bianca picked a good one." This was also weird, like an arranged marriage, but we were standing in the basement of a gay bar in Indianapolis, Indiana, smack bang in the middle of the 3-day Pride Festival. Bianca Del Rio had performed there the night before and had already flown out to her next gig, so we didn't get to see each other, but she'd sent me a text. "Girl, there's a boy there that I picked out for you. His name's Taylor. He'll be your security guard. I don't know why she's Southern. Don't say I never give you nothing." Well, she's from New Orleans. I guess that's sort of, yeah, that's the South. Okay, that was right. I can hear her voice so strongly in my head, but whenever I try and impersonate it, it doesn't quite, I mean, it's quite unique. Anyway, I digress. Taylor and I now had the dressing room to ourselves, and I was still staring into his big blue-grey eyes that were turned down slightly in the corners, which made him look innocent and vulnerable. His hair was brown and floppy, and he had lovely full lips and a strong jawline. He was an all-American, corn-fed, white-bread, Midwestern boy, the kind you might see on an Abercrombie and Fitch bag. As it happened, when he wasn't protecting drag queens, he was in fact an Abercrombie & Fitch catalogue model, which is still pretty good. It's not like a Kmart catalogue, you know. "Hi, I'm Courtney," I said coyly. "I'm Oscar," he said with a slight grin. "I thought your name was Taylor." "That's my work name. I also dance here on the other nights." "Oh, I get it. I have two names too. I'm Courtney, but sometimes I'm Shane." We still hadn't broken eye contact, and I snapped out of my daze in a cartoon-style head shake. Oscar told me that he was a stripper and offered to do a number in the show, and I told him I would love that. Later, I shouldn't have told you it was a sex story. I feel like I just gave away the punch. No, but there's a plot twist. Later that night, after my second number, it was Taylor's turn to take the stage. The room was packed with screaming straight girls and queer people. Extra busy because it was Pride and there was a Rue girl in town. Usually the crowd... Oh, see, I've offended someone already. They're leaving. It's okay. They were like, you know what? I don't know if I'm here for the anal sex. I'm just going to cut my losses and... Usually the crowd at a queer bar like this would have been patrons crammed standing room only in the front of the stage. But this place had kind of strip club vibes with chairs circled around little cocktail tables and a long catwalk off a raised stage. Lots of club lighting and a big LED video wall. It felt cozy but very high tech for a regional bar in Indiana. The drag queen host announced Taylor as the next performer and the locals got excited. I didn't have Magic Mike expectations for the show, but as Taylor unbuttoned his light purple business shirt with navy pinstripes to reveal the Abercrombie body that went with his Abercrombie face, I went from being lost in his eyes to lost in his abs. He kept glancing across at me and smiling, and after he peeled his shirt from his body, he swung it in the air and threw it my way. I caught it theatrical and breathed in all of the pheromones. The people in the crowd were cheering and throwing dollar bills at the stage. After Taylor's number, we continued our coy flirtation backstage. He said that I could keep the shirt that he threw at me, which is how I was able to write that accurate description, because I still have it in a box in storage in Los Angeles. I can't wait to find it one day when I'm, you know, clearing out my things because I'm preparing for death and see that shirt and think about that night. My mum and dad are doing that at the moment, a little prematurely, but they keep sending me all these childhood things that they've kept for the last 35 years. Anyway, I was excited by what the rest of the night might entail. I didn't want a quick fumble in the dressing room, but I was also aware that Oscar identified as straight, had only ever been with cis girls before, and was a gentleman. I was only in town for one night, and I had to be ready to go to the airport at 6:30 the next morning. But you make hay while the sun shines, and there was a lot of sunshine and hay to be made in Indianapolis. I was trying to work out the best way to ask him if he wanted to continue the evening with me somewhere more private when he beat me to it. Excuse me, Courtney. I was just wondering if you'd like some company this evening in your hotel room. Why, yes, Oscar, I would. There was something so simple and sweet about Oscar. He was only 21 and seeing the world for the first time. I was the older woman at age 32. He hadn't seen Drag Race and didn't know anything about me beyond what he had seen that night. In a world where I felt like everyone had a preconceived notion about who I was, it was refreshing to meet a stranger. After a cloak and dagger operation to get Oscar into the car to allow him to be discreet in his small town, we got to the hotel. I kept the lighting as dim as I could muster, with just a single lamp providing enough illumination to blur the mundane surrounds into the background and bring Oscar's eyes into focus. We started very slow and sweet, soft kisses and a lot of eye contact. And as we slowly peeled off each other's clothes, I checked to see he was comfortable with the pace and with everything that was going on. It wasn't my first time at the Straight Boy Rodeo. And I was aware that it was all very new for him. I was now in a bra and undies, and Oscar was only in a pair of white jocks. And I ran my hand down his hard body to his crutch. Is this okay? Yes. He whispered. I continued to trace the path my hands had explored with my lips and tongue. As he was a newcomer to fellatio, performed by a person with a penis, I wanted to give him the full service experience. You know, you can't forget any of the anatomy. You've got to get those balls in your mouth and use your tongue on the taint while you work the shaft. And I was almost certain that this was the first time that Oscar's asshole had been touched by anything other than toilet paper. And there was something thrilling, knowing that no person had ever got their mouth this acquainted with this part of his body before. It's easy to make a straight guy come from oral. It is. It's almost pathetic if it wasn't so hot. But I wasn't ready for this to be over that quickly, even though at 21, I'm sure that Oscar would have more than one round in him. So I eased off as his breathing grew heavier and slower and his yelps got louder, and I worked my way back to his mouth. Then he nervously slid his hand down my body and around my cock. I'll stop blushing. He seemed to enjoy it enough that he decided to go down for a closer inspection and taste.
How long's that?
A muffled voice asked from down below. Great, I answered. In truth, it was a little bit toothy, but what's to be expected for a first-timer, you know? And as Oscar came back up to kiss me, I rolled him onto his back and straddled him. I rolled a condom on his rock-hard cock and slathered it and my hole with lube. We did edit some bits out, so this is much less explicit than the actual book. As I slid his throbbing member... No, that's not him. We stared deep into each other's eyes again as I slid him inside me. His breath turned into groans and so did mine. I could feel sweat lubricating our bodies as Oscar let out a groan and I fell down in a heap on top of him. After a few minutes of lying in silence of the afterglow, Oscar started to stammer something that he'd been working up to. I don't know when I'll be in this position again. Do you want to put it in me? Why, yes, Oscar, I do. I really admired his pragmatic thinking and zest for new experiences. It was a turn on, you know? It didn't matter that we had both just come. I was up again and ready for it. And I engaged the Courtney Act patented lubing technique. Lots of silicone-based lube, and not just slapped around the hole. It's more like you're trying to grease the inside of a bottle rim. This is a common mistake. These are the things people need to know. They do not teach you this. People are like, oh yeah, lube. But when you think about it, something's going in, so what you want is the inside to be lubey. Slowly and gently, taking it nice and easy. Sometimes first-timers think that they can just sit straight down on a penis and are quite shocked by the pain. Oscar was about to experience a whole new level of pleasure, and I knew it wouldn't take long for him to climax. Often on a first time, there isn't much thrusting back and forth, just getting it in is enough of an accomplishment. Afterwards, we both lay there staring at the ceiling, catching our breath with smiles on our faces. And, you know, in a perfect world, we would have woken up and gone for breakfast, or maybe we would have stayed in bed all day, snuggling and fucking. But alas, I had to shower, pack, and hopefully get a few hours sleep before my flight. I didn't want him to leave, but I did need to shower. And even though we had just experienced a most intimate act, there was still the artifice of drag between Oscar and me. I was wearing a bra, wig, and makeup, at least from my nose up. The makeup from my nose down was somewhere between Oscar's legs. I told him that when I got back from the shower, I wouldn't look like a girl anymore, and he looked a little bit confused, but he said he would stay. And after my shower, I styled my wet hair and wrapped my towel around my waist, getting myself as cute as possible for Shane to meet Oscar. And I felt a bit nervous. You know, would Oscar want to kiss me as a boy, or would he just put on his clothes and politely say goodbye? And after a moment's hesitation, there was a smile of recognition as Oscar realized it was still me. And he leaned in and started to kiss me, which was the greatest relief and also turn on. And as the kisses got faster, the towel came off and we did it all again. But this time Oscar made love to Shane. At 5:30 a.m., we were rudely awoken by my alarm clock, the sound of which you might remember from an earlier story, having had about an hour's sleep. And after hitting the snooze button a few times to nuzzle back into Oscar's arms, I frantically got up and packed my suitcase. Oscar's boss from the club drove us to the airport, and Oscar and I took the back seat. I felt Oscar's hand slide on top of mine, and in the rear vision mirror, I noticed his eyes looking at me, and he put his head on my shoulder. At Indianapolis Airport, we had our goodbye kiss, and I wondered whether, once I got out of the car and he drove off into the distance, and once the intoxication of the previous hours had worn off, that he would return to his heteronormative world where boys fall in love with girls and forget all about me. Then again, I hadn't expected Oscar to come in the car with us to the airport, to be so affectionate in the daylight, or to kiss me in front of his boss. You know, usually these straight guys would scamper off before the sun came up. Maybe Oscar would be different, if But would I ever see him again? When would I ever be back in Indianapolis? And there was no point wondering about the future that hadn't happened yet. I would just have to wait to find out. Thank you.
A perfect note to end on. We cut like 1,000 words of sex. You really should buy the books. Indeed, you should buy the works of these 5 fantastic authors. Can we have another round of applause for what a beautiful collection of stories tonight? While you're applauding, please, a round of applause for Neil and Kiri, our fantastic Auslan interpreters tonight. Thank you so much to Michaela, Jean and Sonia and the entire Melbourne Writers Festival for supporting this event. It really is good to be back. Make sure you follow Queer Stories on Facebook, as I am, if anyone's on Facebook anymore, I don't know. You can follow me on Twitter and Instagram. I am hoping to get regular events happening again in Melbourne next year. Subscribe to the podcast in the meantime. There's about nearly 300 stories on there, and you can pick up the Queer Stories book at the bookshop. So there's 6 books, or more, for some of them who've written multiple, that you can purchase tonight. I realised I didn't check if the authors are doing signings at the evening events. Yes. So if you pick up a book tonight, the authors, you'll be able to go and meet them and have a little chat and get your book signed. Thank you again. I won't be there. I'm not famous enough to sign mine. But thank you again. You've all been a fantastic audience. Good night.
Thanks for listening. This series was recorded on the lands of the Wurundjeri Woiwurrung people of the Kulin Nation, the traditional owners of the land on which we work. We pay our respects to the people of the Kulin Nation and all Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander elders past and present. If you enjoyed this discussion and would like to support Melbourne Writers Festival, you can make a donation of any size at mwf.com.au.